the AM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and...
We don't have time for the introduction today. We got to get going. School for Startups Radio, thank you so much for being with us. We have an amazing show. First up, AJ Rice, maybe the top publicist in the United States. I'll let you decide. But the way he built his career, I want you to listen very closely in the first 2 or 3 minutes as he describes how he built his career. It's one of the best stories I've ever heard. Betsy Four is with us after that. Forbes 30 Under 30, maybe the top Native American entrepreneur in the United States. Great show. We're going to get started right now. I am very excited and honored to welcome to the show AJ Rice. He is the GOAT, the all-time greatest conservative public relations expert out there. He is a columnist, humorist, author, and probably the most successful public relations person alive. His company, Publius, how do you pronounce it? Publius PR has represented some people, a guy named Donald Trump, Laura Ingraham, Judge Jeanine Pirro, Donald Trump Jr., Charlie Kirk. The list goes on and on and on, including my favorite, Victor Davis Hanson. He has produced, he was the executive producer of the Laura Ingraham Show and the Monica Crawley Show, and has been active in behind-the-scenes politics with organizations, you know, that are setting the stage and telling us what we're going to be doing. He is very active in the Capital Research Center and the Federalist Society as well. AJ, welcome. How are you doing?
Great to be here, sir. Really, it's an honor. You know, I mean, the thing about me is I've always sort of made my next job, right? So, I mean, I was I'm a geriatric millennial. I'm an old millennial. I'm about as old as a millennial as you can be. So, you know, I remember VCRs and John Hughes, whereas the younger millennials born in the 90s don't really get down like that. I went to Catholic school outside of Philadelphia, went to a state school, Penn State University, and, you know, began volunteering on campaigns and trying to figure out the political world. Even though, quite frankly, I came out of the sort of humanities department world where, you know, English literature and history and things like that. And I got hitched to a congressional campaign in 2004, found my way to D.C., saw an opening on the Laura Ingraham radio show, and basically went in as like a 24-year-old intern. I look like a kid who, you know, because I look young now and I'm 45. I look like a kid who stole his dad's suit back then. And, you know, they brought me in and, I was there working as an intern for maybe 4 months. And the associate producer left. I took her job. Then the executive producer left 9 months later. And like Dick Cheney did when George W. Bush told him to go find a vice president, I found myself and I sat next to the great lady for about 5 years. And then some of the other shows you mentioned and sort of converted being a radio producer of top 10 shows to essentially reverse engineering my daily routine. So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, when you produce a show and Jim knows this, you know, you got tons of incoming. You know, everyone wants to be on your show. Now, when you have 400 stations and you're the most listened to female radio host in the United States, like Ingraham was at the time, you know, we've got every congressional office. We've got, you know, every publishing house. It's all coming in, incoming to my inbox. So I said to myself, you know what? What if instead of being the guy that answers the door, I become the guy who knocks on the door? And get into the harassment business, right? So I basically, first couple clients were fairly famous. That helped. And from there, over the last 10, 15 years, I have built what is pretty much the sort of most well-known right-of-center PR shop, not just in D.C., but, you know, there's not much competition left at this point that I haven't put a toe tag on.
Is there a left-centered version of you?
Yeah, most of them. Yeah. So it helps that a lot of the mainstream media leans to the left. Now, some of that's changing a little bit. It helped that, you know, a lot of the newspapers lean to the left, and some of that changes a little bit. But, you know, conservatives have dominated in some different spaces. Talk radio is one of them. Podcasting was kind of a mixed bag, but if you look at the state of the world now, especially in the political entertainment podcasts, a lot of them are you know, the names, you know, the Rogans, the Theo Vaughns, the Steve Bannons, the Donald Trump Juniors, the Andrew Schultz, and all the rest of it. A lot of them do lean to the right now. Now, some of these people, Adam Carolla and others, they started out as comedians and other things, but world events pushed them. I mean, I don't think Rogan woke up and said, you know, I want to be, you know, a right winger today. I'm gonna get Trump on my show. This was a slow drip, 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 drip. So, you know, there's more spaces than ever to find shows to put conservatives on. Now, with that said, the 2024 election kind of reset the table. I mean, we could always put people on with Megyn Kelly and Tucker Carlson and Hannity and Mark Levin and so on. They were always open to us. But now the podcast world is looking for more and more people from, you know, the right of center space. Look, Gavin Newsom had Charlie Kirk on his show about a month or so before Charlie was assassinated. And if you look at some of the corporate behavior since the 2024 election, not just the tech companies that are all hanging out at the White House now. Look, Larry Ellison, Oracle, right? Him and his son, they just bought Paramount. You know, in the 70s, Paramount was owned by Gulf and Weston. Gulf and Weston financed Chinatown, Love Story, The Godfather, all kinds of movies. And Paramount Pictures was the movie company that was bleeding money. You know, Gulf and Weston was trying to shut them down all the time. But now, not only has Larry Ellison, who's an ally of Trump, him and his son, taken over Paramount. Well, what comes with Paramount? Well, here's what comes with Paramount. Paramount Plus, for sure. So that's all your Yellowstone shows and Landman and Tulsa King and all those shows. But guess what else comes with it? CBS News. CBS News comes with it. Well, the first thing they did is they went and hired Barry Weiss, who, again, is no creature of the right. She's not a creature of the right. She's, you know, a millennial, left-wing, Jewish, you know, fair reporter who was let go by the New York Times because she didn't want to toe the line and drink the Kool-Aid of wokeism, of political correctness, of cancel culture. So she went out, she went on the Substack, you know, which is where a lot of entrepreneurs go, and she created a massive publication. Well, guess what? Larry Ellison and his son just put her in charge of CBS News. Now, do I think I'm going to turn on CBS News now and see, you know, Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens or, you know, Brian Kilmeade? I don't think so. But what I think I'm going to get is fairness. See, at some point, fairness got labeled conservative, independent got labeled. That's how far the ball had been taken in the media to the left, is that standing at the 50-yard line meant you were a right winger. And that's just not the case. So, look, I think things are changing. I think it's great. And it does provide a firm like ours more spaces and venues to put out a whole host of, you know, different voices.
AJ, the thing I would be afraid of is that I'm not Don Jr. in that I would get lost in an agency like yours.
No way. Because here's the thing. We basically have three divisions. Okay. Now, obviously there are, you know, very, very high profile people, and we worked on both of Don's books, and I actually go on his show now as a guest, which is interesting. He's like interviewing his own publicist. Ah! But, you know, we build people up from, you know, relatively unknown. And we don't just do political stuff. We do memoirs and sports books and history books and self-help stuff and, you know, different types of, you know, economic advice and prosperity preachers and near-death experience people. I mean, you want to have some fun. One of the weirdest people that ever called me, you'll love this, was a lesbian couple, left-wing lesbian couple, who wrote a book called Two Bipolar Chicks. So not only were they lesbians and left-wingers, they were bipolar, and they were in a relationship with each other. Can you imagine? It's like a sitcom. This is like, it is. You know, now this show would be hilarious.
It's so crazy.
I mean, you can't believe it. I think you could probably find that book on Amazon. I think the book's called Two Bipolar Chicks. And you know what? It's the weirdest thing in the world. Everyone loved them. All because look, you know, when you're AJ Rice and you're basically Thanos or Darth Vader on the right at the center of the MAGA cinematic universe or the MAHA cinematic universe, where you represent everyone from RFK Jr. to Pete Hegseth. I mean, the reality is that, you know, we don't have a lot of friends at CBS News. Now, we might get them. You know, we don't have a lot of friends at CNN, you know, and you just kind of have to wear it. You know, I'm an Eagles fan. I'm a Philadelphia sports fan. I wear it. All the awful things you think about us is true. We don't care. We wear it. Sixers, Phillies, Flyers, Eagles, the whole deal. If you like soccer, the Union. If you like lacrosse, the Wings. But the reality is that you just have to wear it. So I know who takes me to the dance and who doesn't take me to the dance. But I can tell you, Two Bipolar Chicks was like a smash hit. But, you know, when I got the phone call, I thought it was a joke. And all these right wingers put these two on, and they were kind of funny. It was kind of like, you know, lesbian Three's Company, but they weren't that great looking. But the reality, they were a hit, and they sold a lot of books. And I came up with all, you know, here's the thing. And entrepreneurs know this. Take risks. And if you're really good at something, from time to time, take on a project that makes you feel uncomfortable. Because it's in the space of being uncomfortable where you're going to experience growth or you're going to learn something. You know, Friedrich Nietzsche used to say, you know, I love what I know, but true wisdom comes from what I don't know. It comes from the cracks in the sidewalk. It doesn't come from the sidewalk. What's in there? What will this do? How will this change me? You know, now, granted, obviously, I have my own principles. So, you know, if the mayor-elect of New York were to call me tomorrow, I would take his phone call and I would try to, you know, convince him not to do stupid things and destroy the financial capital of the world, New York City. But, you know, I certainly wouldn't be able to help him with any PR. It just wouldn't fly. Now, with that said, and this is a funny thing because you mentioned the Federalist Society earlier. Federalist Society, ladies and gentlemen, is the largest group of conservative lawyers in the country. It's like a conservative version of the American Bar Association, you know, and they have conventions and they have, you know, they weigh in on Supreme Court picks and all the rest of it. Now, their liberal counterpart, I guess, would be the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. Would you believe, Jim, they called me once. They called me and asked for help reaching right of center media. Now, again, like with the two bipolar chicks, I was like, there's no way this is a prank. One of my people pranking me. There's no way. Well, I get on the call and it's real that my name was given to them by Rand Paul's office. And it turned out it was an issue that we were aligned on, and it had to do with spying on Americans. This was pre-COVID, you know, it had to do with, you know, the Patriot Act and spying on Americans and the fact that Obama was, you know, droning people without trial, you know, just shooting missiles down out of drones, and had to do with, you know, the tapping of a lot of journalists' phones. I mean, Eric Holder had the Associated Press tapped. He had James Rosen tapped at Fox News. It was, you know, we all forget this because we're all stuck in Trumpville and how horrible he, you know, he's ultra MAGA and he's doing this and civil liberties are being trampled. I mean, Obama very casually, like a Mac Daddy, out in the open, was listening in on journalists' phone calls. Cheryl Atkinson, speaking of CBS News, somebody got into her computer. It was the government. So look, you know, the ACLU called and I said, all right, let's do it. So I'm probably the only PR firm in Washington that's worked with both the ACLU and the Federalist Society.
That is an interesting match. What do you think of the war going on right now over Israel, AJ? And the Charlie Kirk assassination, I think, is bringing Israel into the forefront. And
well, it shouldn't. I mean, look, full disclosure, Charlie was our client. I worked on his last book. I think there are a lot of people that are going down into rabbit holes that, you know, if you put a Rorschach test in front of them, they would find the secret evil Jews every time. They're in their attic. They're under their desk. They're popping out of their glove box when they're riding around. And I think some of it is a bit grotesque. Now, with that said, no country on earth is devoid of sin. These are imperfect countries filled with imperfect beings. And some of them are closer to liberty than others. So if you want to critique how Israel acquits its war or its politics, just like if you want to critique England allowing the entire third world to come in there and set up shop, or the United States under Joe Biden or the United States under Donald Trump, this is all fair game. But the problem is with some people, and I don't think there's as big a debate as you just made out. There's a few people that have very big audiences that are apparently willing to go the full Oswald Mosley on this, the full Mussolini on this. And that is that, you know, they, for whatever reason, jump ball and basketball, right? Start of the game, ball goes in the air, and the centers try to tip it to a guard or someone forward that's, you know, around them. So on a lot of issues, when the ball goes in the air, it appears through projection and very little facts, like looking at a Rorschach test, there are people that think the evil Jews are behind bombing Iran, you know, bombing Iran, Epstein files, Charlie Kirk's assassination. Now, some of these things, there are facts involved that show that, you know, especially with Epstein, that he certainly looks like he was some sort of intelligence officer for a foreign entity. Now, it might be Israel. It might be Israel and others. You know, so look, these things will hash their way out in the media. And as you know, the marketplace will speak. The marketplace will speak. But I would just caution any of my right of center friends that, you know, are going to go down some of these conspiracy rabbit holes on some of these things, that, you know, you're sharing positions on things with Zoran Mamdani. You're sharing positions on things with Hamas and Hezbollah and the Ayatollahs in Iran. You have the same perspective as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar and Rashid Tlaib. So, you know, be careful what you wish for. You know, be careful how far down the kooky rabbit hole you go, because, you know, if you're going to build your entire audience on, you know, hunting for the secret Jews everywhere, I would say as a PR person, don't do that. The optics of it are terrible. Financially, I don't think there's a lot of money there. You know, I don't, you know, the Ku Klux Klan at Christmas time, they're out front of Walmart with a pot, just like the Salvation Army asking for money. I mean, I'm joking. My point is, I don't see a lot an economic benefit. I don't see an audience growth benefit to it. But But then again, you know, we are talking about the scapegoats of history, I guess, beginning with Egypt and coming all the way forward to today. So I guess we're probably due for another round of this, Jim.
Who are the two candidates in 28?
You're going to be looking at some combination of Vance, Rubio, and Hegseth. And maybe Don Jr. I don't know. But I would say it's going to be some combination of those four men.
Versus Newsom?
I don't think so. No. I don't think so. I don't think Newsom, there's too much baggage there. I mean, the amount of the commercials you can run on Newsom. California is not Wisconsin. Yeah, Democrats in California are not Democrats in Wisconsin. So, you know, if he somehow gets through there, I mean, the amount of commercials we can run, the amount of Pacific Palisades residents that are Democrats willing to do commercials tomorrow all day long about him and Karen Bass is like, you know, the Mississippi River. That's how long it is. Now, look, here's the thing. And I don't know how much time we have. The audience needs to remember something. And I know we don't like to get too political here, but the Democrat Party, unlike the Republican Party, even though they're trying to play these games with Epstein and Charlie Kirk and Israel and all the rest of it, the Democrat Party has not allowed its base to have a say in an election since Barack Obama in 2008. They have rigged every single primary election on the Democrat side. And you say, oh, AJ, big word, rigged. I'm going to walk you through it right now. Okay. And it's not like, it's not like it's conspiracy theories or anything. It's very simple what they did. Okay. It doesn't have to do with zip drives and shadow Dominion voting and all the rest. It doesn't have to do with any of that. It has to do with humans moving pieces around. Here's what happened. Obama gets, obviously nomination in 2012. So after 2012, here comes Hillary again. She's finally going to get her shot. And Bernie Sanders is sucking up the money, sucking up the energy, and he's going toe-to-toe with her on delegates throughout the entire primary process. Now, we know what I'm about to say next because Donna Brazile put it in her book because she was there. That Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was the head of the DNC at the time, congresswoman from Florida, they basically conspired to keep Bernie Sanders away from the platform. They used something called superdelegates, okay? Superdelegates, which was basically big money people, to keep his people away from weighing in on the platform, away from the convention, and to ensure that there wasn't going to be some kind of floor fight, a convention fight. They basically quarantined the Bernie people. And then you fast forward 4 years later in the middle of COVID. I don't know whether you remember this. Mayor Pete wins Iowa. Go to New Hampshire. No one knows, even to this day, who won New Hampshire. I don't know whether you remember this. But all the news broadcasts were in New Hampshire in 2020. And they're like, we don't know who won. And no one seemed to care who won the Democrat primary in New Hampshire. So off to South Carolina we went. And that's when the call went out. The call goes out from Jim Clyburn, from the Clintons, from the Obamas, from everybody. Get out of the race. Now, Kamala was already out of the race. But there goes Pocahontas. There goes Cory Booker. There goes Klobuchar. There goes Mayor Pete. They all get out. And the only people left, again, are Biden and Bernie. They take Biden. They park him in the basement in Delaware. They hook him up to the extension cord in the basement during COVID. And away we went. And again, Bernie Sanders was quarantined all the way up through the convention. They didn't really have a convention because of COVID. You know, the convention was Biden in the basement with the mask on talking to the Zoom camera. Fast forward 4 more years. They send the vegetable, Joe Biden, out on stage. He gets decapitated by Trump. Trump didn't even have to hit him that hard. It was like he could have hit him with a leaf blower and he would have flown apart. They then get a sitting president of the United States to not run for reelection. They pull a woman who's never won a primary in her life. They decide to not allow the base to speak. They didn't have an open primary. Now, George Clooney and Nancy Pelosi and Obama, they've all weighed in since. Oh, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. But again, they insert this woman who's never won anything. They give her $1.5 billion to light on fire. And in 107 days, she's a disaster. So that's Hillary, Biden, Kamala. Three cycles where they kept the squad, where they kept the Bernie people, where they kept all of the left-wing base away from winning. And if you think for one second they're not going to try to do that again, maybe Gavin Newsom is the happy medium for them. You know, because he's a white male governor and, you know, he's got a little bit of style and he's not, you know, but he's still pretty left wing guy and with this made a lot of mistakes. He's carrying around a lot of baggage, you know. But if you listen carefully to AOC and Jasmine Crockett, they have said on podcast, Jim, that the Democrat Party is looking for a Southern white boy. To try to, I guess, try to, you know, recreate the Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton model. But they don't have a deep bench and they don't really have a lot of options in the Midwest or the South to choose from. And the name I keep hearing is Andy Beshear, the governor of Kentucky. He's their one, the great white hope. He's their one guy. And if you think for one second, the Mamdani people and the AOC people are going to allow this to happen again, you are crazy.
Well, I can't wait to see how it plays out, and it's going to be fascinating. AJ, we haven't even talked about the book yet. Give us 1 minute on your newest book, please.
Look, you know, I do political humor. You know, I was raised on Rush. My job, like his was, to use irreverent humor to illustrate truth. So volume one, The Woking Dead, which you can get in all forms, to, you know, paperback, hardback, you know, digital. You can get an audio. And then volume two, which came out last year, the White Privilege album, is the sequel. And volume three will actually be out next year. These are, look, we're having some fun here. They're different. But, you know, I'm a cultural devotee. A lot of sports in there, a lot of culture, some entertainment. And I'm kind of pushing back on the sort of takeover of our culture. And look, we've had some victories. We've had some victories here. You know, the richest man in the world basically threw in with conservatives. The biggest podcaster in the world threw in with conservatives. And the oldest male heir of the most famous Democrat family in the last 100 years, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., threw in with us. So look, people can be converted, you know? So, you know, you can you get yourself a copy of the White Privilege album, just came out of paperback, have yourself a White Privilege album Christmas. And maybe you can convert some of your blue-haired nieces and nephews this holiday season.
AJ, how do we find out more, get in touch, follow you online?
Yeah, everywhere. Publius PR, AJ Rice. I'm on pretty much every handle. AJRicePR.com, PubliusPR.com. And, you know, if you're looking for the best prices of books, you got to go to Amazon because we got to all chip in to help pay for that Bezos wedding that happened earlier this year.
AJ, thank you so much for being with us. A lot of fun, and we would love to have you back.
You're a patriot, brother. You keep knocking them down, all right? We love you here. Thank you.
We will be right back. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited and honored to introduce another great guest. This is an amazing story. Please welcome Betsy Four to the show. She is a longtime entrepreneur, very successful. She is the founding partner and managing director of Velveteen Ventures. They invest in solutions for children and the planet that are going to help the next seven generations. She was the co-founder and CEO of Tiny Organics, which she grew to $13 million in revenue in just 24 months. She raised some Series A funding, making her the first Native American to raise Series A funding in the United States. She was also the founder of Wonder Woof, one of the first dog active can be monitors and apps, kind of like a baby monitor, I guess, for your dogs. She also has a nonprofit called Natives Rising, which is the largest community of indigenous technologists in the world. And she has won a bunch of awards, Forbes 30 Under 30, Entrepreneurs 100 Women of Impact, and a whole bunch of other things as well. Wow. Congratulations on all of the cool success. welcome. And the book just went to, just announced that it was on the USA bestseller list. She has a new book out called Built on Purpose, Discover Your Deep Inner Why and Manifest the Business of Your Dreams. Betsy Four, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much, Jim. I'm really happy to be here.
It is an impressive story. So let's start with the book.
Yeah.
On Purpose. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So I wrote this book after being a two-time founder for almost 2 decades and noticing when I began investing about 6 years ago that founders were always asking me, what's the blueprint? How did you build these multi-million dollar companies? Especially with my background, not coming from having a friends and family round of funding and needing to go about it in a very kind of different way from your typical venture capital model. And so I thought, let me bundle all this up into a blueprint of sorts with this book, but do it in a way that actually merges the spiritual with the nuts and bolts of building a business and a successful business. And so this is a really different vantage point than most HarperCollins business authors, where I weave in the 7 grandfather teachings of my tribe, the Anishinaabe. I'm Turtle Mountain Chippewa. And those teachings are things like love, bravery, humility, and about 40 other values that I include within the book that allows the reader to pursue their own deep inner why and to embody those values, because that's where I believe creation is born, is when we can move from the scarcity to the abundance mindset. And I think that is actually within all of us and just waiting and willing to be unleashed.
All right. So a little bit of NLP just slipped in there.
Yes.
I caught it. This may be a weird question. Is the entire world of NLP and manifesting and designing your future, is that conducive or is it parallel to Indian Native American teachings?
So I haven't been asked that in particular. I think that the way that I was raised was to approach every situation with the gift, with a give. And that is very like cultural and ingrained in Native American heritage.
You said a gift.
Yes. Yes.
What's the gift you're giving?
Right. So this is something I talk about throughout the book, because I think for founders that come from a sort of non-traditional background in ways that they can approach their asking for their first customers or their investment dollars, right, from their first investors with the offering. So the idea is that you're not actually kind of asking for a handout here. You're really offering something of great value, right, that you're building with your company and with your passion and through your values. And so I do think that there's many parallels here to the way that I was raised and within my own teachings from my tribe, as I mentioned. But, you know, when I started doing this work, it was actually through Natives Rising, my nonprofit that you talked about a moment ago, where our members represent over 100 tribes nationwide. My co-founder, who is Pomo, so her homelands are Silicon Valley, Danielle Ford, her and I became NLP practitioners many years ago now, because we found that the greatest effect of change we were having throughout our community with Natives Rising was actually our healing retreats. So we hold these retreats and these ceremonies with practices that we incorporate from NLP, not all of them, but many of the processes around rewiring your brain through neuroscience and creating new neural pathways to feel like you are living in a state of abundance, right? To come back to that place where we believe, yeah, creation lives and that you have the ability to kind of dream so much bigger, right? When you can come out of this this kind of scarcity mindset or this place of maybe not having, like we all do, right, the negative bias in terms of the loop that's constantly going in your mind, right? How can we counteract that? And so I think based on that work with the nonprofit is when I really began to understand how I had always built companies previously. I didn't call it manifesting at the time. I didn't know a word for it. Actually, I was just on stage at the Eudaimonia conference in Florida this last weekend with Andrew Huberman, and he calls it visualization, right? So visualizing what you want, and that it's in that there's real neuroscience behind this, and there is. So I talk about the white papers and the things that have really impacted my life in terms of understanding this concept and then being able to apply it and put it into practice.
So tell us more about it. Talk to us more about the mindset of abundance.
Yes. So one of the first exercises that I do in the book, once you've pinpointed your top five values that you're focused on during this part of your life and whatever you're building, so it's not about focused on the visualization of what that value lived out could look like. It's the opposite. So it's going back into a time. Let's use courage, for example. Okay. So courage for me is a value, and I'm putting it out there, and I want to embody this feeling. Because you actually have to feel it to reveal it. So it's thinking about one of the many times throughout my life that I have done something brave or courageous or felt like, you know, I was in a place of being brave, right? Maybe in this moment, speaking to you, Jim. So going back and really thinking around what was I wearing? What was the weather like? What color? If you had to associate a color with it, is it hot or cold? So these different modalities, right? Latching onto that specific moment within your journey that you felt that value or that feeling that you're hoping to embody. And then you can anchor to that feeling. So by putting your forefinger and thumb together, we can actually come back to that feeling again and again by truly meditating on it just for those few minutes, trying to remember every detail of when you felt that feeling. I'll tell you, Jim, I just recorded the Audible for the book not too long ago here in downtown Chicago. And I had forgotten how many meditations I'd actually put into the pages of this book over the past 5 years. And this is one of them, right? Where it is, it's almost like a prayer, right? That you can have this grateful heart as you approach that place of having these different experiences where you embodied your values throughout your life. So that's something that I always tell founders or builders or anyone that has an idea wants to get there or maybe doesn't have the idea yet, right? And it's like, well, I know I do want to build something. What could that be? Start with your values and let that be the purpose that is the common thread throughout your life and your journey, because over 90% of the next generation, including my children, want to be entrepreneurs. They want to build something. What does that mean, right? And this book is looking to distill that it really does start with your values and that unique vantage point that you can offer to the market based on your experiences and your background. And it's almost an unfair advantage, right, that you have in solving a particular problem or an idea that you would come up with.
Amazing. Absolutely fascinating. Tell us about Velveteen Ventures and the work you're doing there. And is seven generations something special in Native American cultures? And I hate to do this, but on that yes. TV show Yellowstone, they talked about that the family had been there for seven generations, and then they tore the house down at the end of the series and stuff and gave the land back to the Native Americans. What's up with seven generations?
Yeah, so in our culture,
there's like 12 questions there, Betsy.
I know, there's so many questions, but it is like, that's what's so beautiful about this, Jim, is like every company that I ever built was actually born from my love for family. So my very first company that you mentioned, the Wonder Wolf bow tie, a Fitbit for dogs, that was for my first baby, my dog Whiskey, who just turned 14 years old. He was 1 year old at the time. My next company, Tiny Organics, that you talked about, you know, growing into those multi-millions in dollars in revenue, that was all built for my first son, Sebastian. And then when Natives Rising, when I launched my nonprofit, my son Azure was born, who's named after our surname on the reservation. I actually closed the first institutional round of funding for my venture capital firm the day my daughter was born, almost a year ago now to the day. And so literally every baby has inspired a movement and a creation. And you know, you mentioned it, but in Native American culture, we do believe we are building. Well, first of all, we're what our ancestors prayed for, right? So we have a responsibility to our ancestors and our lineage and our heritage here on this earth, but also we look towards everything we're doing in the little small decisions each day. How would that affect the next seven generations? And try to keep that in our mind's eye. So when I partnered to launch Velveteen Ventures, where she saw the permafrost melting firsthand, then just like myself, first in her family to go to college, she dedicated her entire life to fighting climate change and built seven climate funds. The most recent one one for the founder of Patagonia, the clothing company, Yvonne Chouinard. He had asked her, I want to give all my revenue to the earth. Carla, can you figure out what that looks like? Her name's Carla Brolier. And she built the Patagonia Purpose Trust and then spun out the Home Planet Fund, which deploys all the revenue from Patagonia to indigenous tribes globally. So when we joined forces on this work, it was two issues that our culture, our community, our families care deeply about, and that's children, but then what planet are they going to inherit, right, for the next seven generations? So Velveteen Ventures is not an impact fund. We're a proper ROI-driven, thesis-driven venture capital firm. We plan to make massive returns for our LPs, but we do that through the lens of really building for the next seven generations. And so Carla and I have done this where we baked a portion of our carry or our equity within Velveteen Ventures to go directly back to Native American tribes. We don't have a mandate in terms of the type of founder that we back, but it just so happens our entire track records are backing women and underrepresented founders in particular, myself through X Factor Ventures and Long Jump Ventures previously. I was an operator for those two decades. I was in investing for these 6 to 7 years. When I thought about building Velveteen, I thought, what name could embody these sort of like seven generations thinking, right? Well, it turns out that the children's storybook, The Velveteen Rabbit, has been around for about that long. And my grandmother had gotten me a Velveteen Rabbit. It was actually just a plush rabbit from Goodwill that I loved so much that I believed he could become real, right? From the time I was 5 years old. And he now lives with my son. and so still here today. That's what founders wake up and do every day, right? They pour enough love, care, attention into something. They believe it can be real. And I wanted to let them know I also believe, and I'm alongside them for that journey.
I love it. What a great, great way of expressing that, Betsy. What if my purpose is not altruistic? What if my purpose is I just want to feed my family? Is that okay?
Yep. Absolutely. So I talk about that in the book as well. The book is really catered towards like the business sense of building companies or building, something that you want to put out into the world. I also have a whole section on how that's not everyone's calling or thing that they think is going to make the greatest ripple, right, in their one precious life. And that is, we all honor that, of course, right? This is part of the journey. And I think for many in my community and founders that I have act and work with, there is this idea of like, how can I balance both, right? Like needing to, provide for my family, right? But then also wanting to live my greatest truth or purpose in this life. I think that's what the book is seeking to do here, is to really hone in on how to do the internal work to feel abundant, because that's what actually attracts all these incredible things into your life, is when you can embody those values that we talked about earlier. So I definitely think, I firmly believe that anyone that wants to can be a builder and build something. And that I'm hoping that these practices, the way they changed my life and many founders I work with, including 20 I feature throughout the pages of the book, could serve as inspiration, and really, a guidepost for folks to be able to center on their deep inner why.
Tell us about some of the people you write about. Those are always cool stories.
Yes, definitely. So one of them is my previous boss, the founder of Calm, the meditation app. So I actually moved out to London not knowing anyone. This is a really like kind of wild story. This was almost 2 decades ago now. And just asked to meet with Michael. Well, once I finally did, he hired me on the spot. We built that company. I led all the product there. We grew it to over 90 million registered users online. And then I built us the number one toy brand in all of UK for 6 years on, beating even Star Wars and Lego. And that's what kind of gave me the launch pad to be able to launch my companies thereafter. But Michael went on to launch Calm right during that time as well. And I'll never forget when I had the idea for this book and I began writing it, I was sitting with him in a cafe in London and I said, what you've done for meditation by bringing it to the masses and making it less woo, right? More accessible. I want to do for manifestation because I believe that we are all, especially founders and builders, right? The ultimate manifestors because we build something out of nothing, right? It's this idea that you have and the pitch deck is like your vision board, right? And I want to dissect this and like put it into these pages. And so I do share Michael's story throughout and how his journey, just like my own, is actually standing on a mountain of failures. So every success you see, right, has so many failures behind it. And I thought that was really important to highlight throughout the book. There's actually over 20 founders featured in the book that I've interviewed, dear friends of mine throughout my journey. Over half are women, a third are Native American. Some have IPO'd, some are double unicorns. So it's phenomenal to get to learn from these different perspectives around how they also built on purpose.
How did you get HarperCollins and... tell us your publishing story. It's always all of our listeners want to publish a book. So how did you get able to do that?
Yes. And I had no concept of the publishing world whatsoever when I started this journey. So it's been so much fun. And I do credit my agents to that and my HarperCollins, Hollis, absolutely. So Hollis is a legend in the industry in terms of HarperCollins business. She published everything from Hard Thing About Hard Things to all the Gary Vee books, all the Tim Ferriss books, Zero to One. I mean, like it literally the list goes on when it comes to building, you know, for startups and business. So she was literally, I mean, I manifested this, right? Like she was literally on the top of my list. And I was like, I have no concept. I have no connection to her, right? Like how I'm going to get this publisher. And so I think that's always important too. And I talk about it a lot in the book, but when you're building your advisory board around your life or around your business, right? How you can have this sort of dream list or this wish list of folks that you sort of think would just be a game changer in whatever you're looking to do or put out in the world. And so Hollis was definitely that for me. So when I met with my agents, I had, so the process itself, when I met, let me take you back for a minute. Betsy, I don't know a founder out there that doesn't have like a ghostwriter or somebody that's helping you to edit this, like throughout your writing process. And so then I really fortuitously got in touch. It was with somebody I was friends with that she had also written a book and I was just speaking it. And I find that really is part of manifesting too, is just putting it out there in the world and just literally just speaking it. And you don't know what's going to come back to you. But what came was my incredible partner in this journey, Nicola, who she actually wrote The Nanny Diaries that became the film with Scarlett Johansson, but she's done many bestsellers over the years and with authors that she has partnered with. And so she was, she's out of Brooklyn where I was based at the time. And we were able to, I feel like we partnered probably 5 years ago now on this. It was like 4 or 5 years we've been working together. And it was through her that we then, she knows the publishing world, right? This is her wheelhouse, that we then, were able to connect with, agents that it was just like stars in my eyes that represent Dolly Parton. And I was like, wow, she is literally, I end my book with a quote from Dolly, find out who you are and do it on purpose. I just, you know, have really, you know, I read her Imagination Library books as a child, right? And I, everything that she stands for, I just really, have looked up to over the years. And so this was like, how is this possible? Here it is, I'm talking to my agent and he's, you know, going onto a call with Dolly after this. And so I was like, okay, I'm really starstruck here. And I wonder if I put this out there, like what I'm hoping is that I could get Hollis, right? Who's with HarperCollins business. And sure enough, when they did the pitch to Hollis, we then had a call the next week. And that's sort of like an interview process, right? That you go through. And we did this, you know, of course with others and she was my, you know, number one that I'd wanted. And I think it was just that energy of knowing that maybe in my heart and that I brought to the conversation that we got the deal. And it was a dream. Like it was a dream deal. I you know, this process was so long. I was kind of thinking the whole time, maybe I won't actually get published or maybe I would self-publish, right? And I was open to different options and avenues because I think, you know, I heard someone say it really well recently, but when you're building something because you feel you have to build it, right? Like how founders often do, that creativity and the thing behind it, that authenticity, it just shines, right? You're not building it for anyone else. And that's what I was doing with this book, was things that had truly changed my life and my journey. I wanted to encapsulate here. And I thought, even if I just self-publish and give this to my founders, it's enough. But the fact that Hollis really saw something in me and published something that she and Michael and others have said, this book literally doesn't exist, right? Or they would have read it, kind of blending the spiritual with the nuts and bolts of building a successful business. And so I was just, yeah, it's just been a dream partnership getting to work with them. And so I'm really, really grateful.
That's a great story, Betsy. It speaks for itself, I think. Very strong testimony to what you're doing and what you're talking about.
Thank you.
How do we find out more? Get in touch, follow online, get a copy of the book.
So it's available in every major retailer. You can also get the links from my site, betsyfor.com. Feel free to follow me on LinkedIn or on Instagram. Also betsyfor on there. Happy to connect there if this resonates with you as well. And so appreciate this time, Jim. This is like amazing. And by the way, can we do our top 10?
Top 10? You mean the quick 10?
The quick 10, yeah.
Sure, let's play. Do you want the wager? Do you want to wager on the outcome, Betsy?
I don't know what that means. I don't think so.
You have to.
Okay.
Number one, favorite creativity hack?
Nature. Being in nature.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick?
Build it on your nights and weekends.
Number three, name your top passions.
Family, mental health care, working with founders. I would say creating generational impact and leading with love.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
Find your deep inner why. And pick a problem that you've experienced firsthand and gives you an unfair advantage. Then attract your team and first believers.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Build it for yourself or your loved ones first.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
The potential that AI has for curing diseases and helping people feel more connected with their care providers in particular.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice?
Follow your values, because the only constant in life is change.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake?
My first company, Wonder Wolf, that we mentioned, I had built it for retailer demand, getting millions in retailer POs. But I did it exactly the opposite at Tiny, where I built up for the customer demand, doing the over $13 million in revenue just based on direct sales alone.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Probably my ex-boss, the founder of Calm that I mentioned earlier, because as mentioned, he built Perplexity prior, Mashi Monsters prior. Calm was really his third rodeo that he was trying to make it. And seeing him go through all that journey and, yeah, to come out a double unicorn in the end, it was just, yeah, so, so thrilling and inspiring.
Number 10, favorite superhero?
I believe that that's founders, the superheroes who can run a business, raise a family, build impact across continents, and then still, you know, answer emails. So probably every working founder that refuses to give up.
All right. How do we get in touch with you? Find out more, Betsy?
You can find me on LinkedIn or betsyfor.com. And thank you so much for this, Jim.
Thank you. Just a second. Oh, Betsy, I'm so sorry. You got a 94 on the quiz. You have to have a 95 to win. I don't know who dinged you, but someone, I don't know what happened. But you owe us a Tesla. We always play for a Tesla. So I'll look.
Whoa. Okay, great. Sounds good. I didn't realize there was a wager.
Oh, you accepted it. I forced you to.
Okay, great.
Today, but you know what we do? That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe. Take care. And go make $1 million. Say bye, Betsy.
Bye. Thank you.
We're out of here. Take care, everyone. Have a good day. Bye now.